have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable, it's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hi, everyone. So today on the show, I'm chatting with my grandmother, my Nana, and this is a really special episode for me. She shares bits and pieces of her life, her growing up as a Black girl, and just recalling things from the civil rights movement and segregation. And we just had a moment, and it was so amazing to be able to hear her voice, hear her story, and listen to her and hold space for her. And I love her so much. She played a major role in raising me and has just been my biggest prayer leader. I remember we were talking one day and she was just saying how she never stopped praying for me and how her prayers have been answered just because I came out on the other side of so much darkness and trauma and sadness, and I was lost, and my grandmother's prayers covered me. I'm just honored to be able to sit and talk with her, and I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. Have a great Sunday. Take care.
Hi, I'm Alex L., and I write books for a living. The Hey Girl podcast was created with sisterhood and storytelling in mind. Hey girl.
Hey girl.
Hey girl.
Hey girl.
Join us as we journey through sharing together. Hey girl.
Hey girl.
I guess I should say hey Nana since I'm talking to my Nana.
Yeah.
How you doing, Nana?
I'm fine, Alex. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm really glad to have you on my podcast. I definitely wanted to just talk with you about social justice, Black lives, everything that's going on right now, and everything that you've, you know, walked through and seen in your lifetime. But before we do that, please let the Hey Girl listeners know who you are and what you do.
Oh, well, I'm Alexandra's Nana, because we don't use the G word around here. And what do? I work for NIH, and I am an office manager.
Right now, we know that an uprising is happening, and you and me and Ryan have had plenty of conversations about race and being Black in America and the different movements that have happened in your lifetime. And what are the parallels between now and what you've witnessed, and how do you feel about everything that's happening right now?
Well, it's the same. Mm-hmm. Every, I don't know if you want to say few years or however you want to say, it's the same march and nothing changes. And from police brutality, which if you think about it, it started back during slavery time when they had the overseers of the slaves. It was the same thing. They watched them and they got out of line or tried to attempt to free themselves. They got beaten. So it's the same, and that was 400 years ago, and we're still facing the same systemic racism in this country. From the civil rights movement, when Dr. King became the spokesperson and formed this, it was because of the same thing, the treatment of Black people not being respected. But the difference then versus now, to me, he had backers, Harry Belafonte, Aretha Franklin, and some of the other ministers. The church was behind it, and they funded it, and they hurt the local economy economically with striking, with the trash folks that, you know, the black people there, and then boycotting the buses. Now, Rosa Parks was not the first one, and forgive me, I can't remember the lady's name, but, and it happened up in New York, who got tired of it, and so, and then the housewives who had to clean their own homes, you know, they went and picked up the maids and all of that. So this is not the first march that we have had to make things change with the civil rights movement because of the death of Dr. King, and that kind of change when Johnson got in. He is the one who signed the civil rights bill, not John F. K. I think he was kind of not comfortable having Dr. King telling him what to do. But after he was killed, Johnson said, we have to do something. So that's how that got passed. And then you go on with the other marches, the Poor People's Campaign, where people marched and built Resurrection City on the mall because of no help from the government to help these people get the same chance in America. And I don't mean those people, our people, the same chance as white America. After Reconstruction, after the Civil War, things looked like they were going to get better. Black folks became senators and businessmen, and just all of these things start happening for them. And the systemic racism in this country, the Klan came out of that and they put a stop to it. And that was during the Jim Crow part of the movement. So bombing and beating up black folks and bombing churches. And you talk about radical folks, the Klan were very radical. They can kill you. They could march down the street with their hoods on and be glorified. So that's my feeling, that I don't think, and I hope and pray, I don't think that this marching, Black Lives Matters, although there was a man that came out to speak to us at NIH, we had during Black History Month, who came to speak. And one of the questions that came up when it was Q&A time, the young lady, an Asian lady, young person, asked him, how did he feel about the Black Lives Matter movement? And he said, that's how the Civil Rights Movement got started. He gave me a little hope maybe something would happen, but that was a couple years ago. And then the shootings have, all the shootings that have taken place during that. And the interesting thing is that, you know, the Fraternal of Police and the police department, they have funds to pay the lawsuits, but still nobody goes to jail. I mean, look at Rodney King. He was beaten and caught on camera, and those guys got off. So I'm hoping that this will make a change, but it starts within government of the United States, not just the local, but up there on that hill. When black folks could not buy homes and all of that, then the housing discrimination came out of that. So they had to sell us home. You couldn't hold it back because of your race, and black folks would buy a little house in a neighborhood, and the white folks would move out. And when they moved out, the schools went down. So is that equal? You know, so it's deeply rooted, in my opinion, in the United States of America, a constitution, and they need to have amendments to change that. But with these politicians, they get their funding, NRA and other, you know, big lobbyist organizations to fund their reelections. So nothing ever happens because they don't want to lose their funding. And there, to me, there you have it. It has to start in the Senate, in the Congress, in those higher places. And tell me if I'm wrong. Even with the military, it was one of the racist places to go. When the slaves were freed, they joined the Union Army to fight the South. But yet, when it was time for the black people wanted to go in the Army to get benefits and to protect their country, they were forced with racism in there. So when they came home, they didn't get the same parade as the white soldiers did. So it's deeply rooted, and it's, I don't know if this march is going to change. It may make a, I don't know. I pray that it helps, but I think once, when you hurt the economy, That's when change happens. And us as Black people, we have to do that. We have to control our dollar and to make a change. And then things happen.
I want to talk to you a little bit about your childhood, your Blackness growing up, the things that you witnessed growing up, your parents, and segregation. You, me and Ryan have had lots of talk about segregation, and you actually said it wasn't the worst thing because the Black dollar was kept in the community. There were Black doctors, Black lawyers, Black midwives, Black convenience stores, Black banks, everything. So I want you to talk a little bit about all of that, but start in your childhood and maybe even your earliest memory of being a Black girl and the segregation that you saw and that you faced growing up.
Well, I grew up in the beginning of my life, early elementary school. We lived, now they call it extended, I guess, Capitol Hill, I don't know, right off New Jersey Avenue between L Street and K Street in D.C. Mm-hmm. And every shop on the corner was Black owned. They called it beauty parlor then. That was Black owned. The shoemaker, or how they call it, the shoe shop, or but we used to call it the shoemaker, the cleaners, the barber. We did have one corner store because they weren't big Safeways and all of that then, at least I remember, because we had the market where you went to buy your fresh vegetables, a farmer's market. So the DGS was, if I'm mistaken, it was Jewish owned, and then there was a Chinese laundry, but everybody else, all the other shopkeepers were Black, and the teachers and the doctors, but we all lived in the same community. Mm-hmm. Now, in my elementary school, I don't remember having white teachers at all, not until I went to high school. In elementary and junior high school, all my teachers were Black. So we didn't have the racism. The first time that I guess it was racism, it was something that you wrote in a piece and you said that, you know, in elementary school, you remember somebody using the N-word. And that brought a memory up to my forefront. My sister and I went downtown D.C. and I'm pretty sure the store was Neisner, and couldn't have been no more than maybe 8, 9, 10 years old. And my sister was, you know, 4 years, 5 years older than me. And we walked into the store and we went down to the basement. I'm following her. And there were two white ladies there as we passed the counter. And I'll never forget this. And she said to the other lady, okay, you better watch them because you know how they are. And I didn't know what that meant at the time. And then she reached out under the counter and had a little small-looking baseball bat. And I remembered that, but I guess nothing happened because whatever my sister was down there to do, we did it and we went on back home. Mm-hmm. But I never spoke about it. And that's the first time that I remember that. And then after we moved from that location, we moved out to Southeast, an area called Benning Heights. And at the time, there was still some whites living in the general area. If you have to walk up the hill to go to, I remember Carl's Hill, or something like that it was called, we walking up. And there were apartments and houses, of course, on the way up there. And white kids, mostly boys, would call us and say names and throw rocks and stuff at you like that. But in return, when the grocery stores delivered groceries, when they would come in our neighborhood, the boys would do the same thing with them, you know, throw rocks or beat them up and, you know, but it was in retaliation. And so I do remember that, but mostly I did not run into a lot just because I guess we all always lived in a Black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So I didn't come across a lot of racism in the terms of they call it, eating us up and things like that, unless I was just oblivious and not aware of it. But, you know, we only went to Black-owned shops, so, and even in the Jewish shop, they were very very open and accommodating. We didn't have the issue like some people. But I do know that after when Black people were moving out into the suburbs, that's when a lot of the issues happened. My family, my mother, you know, we grew up poor. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't move out into the suburbs. We stayed right within the inner city. Mm-hmm. And we had a big boys and girls club and the churches. So that might have helped also.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
It's so interesting that you said that, because Ryan and I were talking last night and he was like, he grew up, you know, in Kansas City, Missouri, Black uh-huh. teachers, Black church, big yep. Black family. He was yeah. like, I didn't have white teachers or white friends growing up. I just didn't. And even to this day, yeah. he's like, I can name the white people that are in my life on one hand. And
yeah.
he was just yeah. like, I didn't have, you know, experiences with white people ever growing up. So he was yeah. just like, how much that is embodied in him and how grateful he is that he grew up hella Black, you know, and yeah. how proud he is of being taught by Black teachers and being led by Black churches and things like that. So it's just interesting, you know, hearing that from you
yeah.
and also hearing that from my husband, who was a young man, you know what I mean? So it's just like,
yeah, that's why I think that my personal feeling with segregation, as long as it's equal, I really don't have a problem with it. The problem comes when Fort Washington, over in that area, and they are wealthy people, you know, middle class, upper middle class, and wealthy folks that live out there. But Prince George's County, I mean, there's no infrastructure. They have no shopping. They don't have the other things that you, I guess, lately here, they've probably added those things. But before, those things weren't there. And the main thing, the school system was horrible. And then, like in Lanham and Sea Pleasant and places like that, the schools had gotten so bad that they started busing. This is when the busing came along, and to send the kids further out, which I and lots of Black parents had a problem with that, to put your 6 or 7 year old on a school bus to go into a community where they're not wanted. It was scary. So we wanted equal. Let our schools be just as funded and as good as the schools that you're busing these children to. The Black woman that from Oakland who was running for president, when yeah. she was debating with Biden, and she said, and I don't know, I can't remember the comment he made and about school busing, and she didn't like it, and she said, yeah, because one of those kids on that school bus was me. And I wanted to just yell in there and say, Black folks did not want busing. Didn't want to put their kids on a bus for an hour going out and an hour back into communities where they were not wanted, and to be subjected to name calling and however they treated them. So I didn't agree with her saying that at all. So segregation, it should have been segregated and equal. And I don't know if the other cities, like when you go to New York, there's Little Italy, there's Little Chinatown, there's, you know, ethnic groups all around, and I don't know, because I don't know how they were treated for wanting to stay within their own community. But with Black folks, it caused confusion amongst us. sometimes we could be our worst enemy, if you know what I mean, with the confusion of watching the television in Madison Avenue, the advertiser say, you know, you're pretty if you look like this or if you look like that, and then, you know, processing the hair and, you know, lightening of your skin and all of that. It's been really difficult for Black folks in this country, and you have seen progress because now we're proud to wear our kinky hair. You know, we're proud of our wide nose or dark skin. And I just hope that by the time my great-grandchildren get up, that this, it won't be so intense anymore, that something will happen. And we're equal. You are born in America from African descendants. When you're born, it makes you American citizen to all the rights here for American citizens. So the government, they got to do something.
So before we wrap up, two more things. Raising a Black son in America, what was that like for you raising my uncle? And like, were you ever worried at all? How was mothering for you? I know you were a young mother. Like, what was that like in your life having a Black son?
Well, having a Black child, period, in raising them. And I probably was a cuckoo mother because I dressed that they have to do well. They have to do well in school. They have to not get caught up with some of the negative things that urban Black kids had to deal with. I left D.C. when your mother, I think she had just turned 12. The schools had gone down because of the struggle in some of the urban, lower class, working class communities. My mother raised us in public housing, and it wasn't a bad word then. Public housing, really affordable housing. It was, everybody went out to go to work. Public housing, and once again, this is the police. And the other thing too, Alex, most of the police, when I was a kid in elementary school, the police officers also were Black, and they walked the beat, and you didn't fear them, you talked to them. They always came to the elementary school. It's officer-friendly day. They lived in the community, so they, it's different than these police today who don't live in these underserved communities. They come in and they go out. And so when the public housing became where mostly non-working welfare folk, it changed. One thing was my mother raising us by herself, working three jobs. She instilled in us pride and ethics. And even though she went to clean white folks' houses on Saturdays and went to Georgetown University during the week, left the house at 5, worked in the athletic department, and then after work she went to cook for priests. And then on Saturdays, because she was too prideful to take welfare, she wasn't going to have it. You know, you worked, and my father did not believe in, he called it buying on time, you know, credit. So we learned the value of working hard and being decent. And when you leave the house, you represent your family and your race when you walk out this door. And she told my brother, if you get in trouble with the police, and this may be harsh, don't call me because you know better. So we came up under, you know, a Bible-toting, strict mother, and, you know, they didn't talk about, you know, mental health or any of that stuff, you know, back then. You know, what goes on in my house stays in my house and all of that. So we kind of grew up that way, and it was good. So you weren't going to take welfare. You had to work hard, and when you work hard, you be appreciative of what you had. And then we went, you know, down the country to see, you know, my mother's family down there, and they had all of this land. And I was talking to your mother about it today. I know I once knew how they got all of that acre, but I forgot. And it, I'm sure it had to come through during after slavery reconstruction when they were giving out the 40 acres and a mule. You know what I mean?
Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I don't remember that at all. But I just know going there and seeing all this land that they grew up on, because they grew up on a farm and had. And I was wondering how that Grandma Kate and how their family got this much land. in. Mm-hmm. So that's my next project, to go and find out how it got into our family. Oh, but you did ask me about my son, him growing up. In some sense, I think I failed him, because when we moved out in Montgomery County, like I said, Victoria was 12, and it was a very mixed community, working class people living all together, mm-hmm. and they had white friends, black friends, and you know, everybody got along, and it was a great area to raise kids. But something happened, and I heard and saw signs of it early, mm-hmm. in terms of him saying, oh, I don't like my hair. I wish my hair was like so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And I just went, he's a kid. What is he talking about? And all of his little friends at the time, boys and girls, they were, Monica was one of his best friends. Her, she was half white, half Japanese. Her mother was Japanese. Narda, she was, I think somewhere in her family, they had to be some Caucasian people. Ngai was Trinidadian. His mother was from Trinidad. His father was black. So there were a lot of ethnicities in the community, but I did not, and if I could go back, I would have talked to him more about how was he feeling growing up in this diverse community. When coming from D.C., it mm-hmm. was just all black folks mm-hmm. that he played with. And he was a young boy, though. I think he might have been, if Victoria was 12, he was 7 or 8, you know. But as he went on and started high school, he started dating just white girls. And not that there's anything wrong, but I think I should have had more conversations with the asking why the preference or something. And I have, and you love who you love, and who you want to date is okay, but it's,
you think there was something more there than just,
well, but I never talked about it, because I think of any race, when you just focus out of your race, man or woman, I think there's something there. For instance, if a black woman only want to date white guys, or a black guy only want to date white girls, or only want to date, I think I failed on that part, not having a talk about it. I just said, oh, well, maybe this is just the choices that he had or something. And what made me aware, there was a lady that moved in with her son who had just moved from Colombia, mm-hmm. and she came back this way. And we were sitting at the pool or something and talking. And she said she moved back up on this end because she was fearful of her son. She never said why, because he only wanted to date white girls, and he was getting slack about it from, I guess, his white high school, white peers or whatever. But she started to fear for him. And that's what brought it to my attention. But I didn't do anything with it. And mind you, I don't have an issue with mixing the races, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but you have to know, I guess, your own child and mental health. Like you said, I never dealt with it.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So before we wrap up, I want to talk to you about self-care. We mentioned this a little bit yesterday on the phone, and how you said it was taboo back then.
Yes.
So I want to talk about, in what ways was it taboo? Like, did you see mama taking care of herself, or was she constantly just showing up and taking care of the family? And then for you, how did you take care of yourself, or how are you taking care of yourself now?
Well, I think now when you know better, you do better. But I think because it was such a taboo, and like I said, growing up, what goes on in this house stays in this house. You didn't talk about it. And after I got an adult and could talk to my mother like Victoria and I are, friends and can talk, she did express things. One thing that she, and during the time that she was doing all that working, and my sister didn't have a teenage life because she had to take care of Russell and I. So that caused issues for her. And it was a lot. It was a lot of burden. I remember I was still working downtown, and Victoria, I think she probably was middle school, and she wanted to go to the mall. This is when kids would take the bus. Safety and go to the mall and all that. And she called me and asked me if she could go. And I said, Victoria, no, you can't go. You gotta watch Torrance till I get home. And so she said to me, why do I have to do that? That's your child. And that opened up my eyes to listen to her. And so my sister, I can imagine how she felt that she had no childhood. So when she turned 18, she ran off and got married. It wasn't successful because my mother, you do as I say. Mm. And kids are to be seen and not heard. And I'm sure that's the way they were raised. And I could tell that she was tired, but she always put us first, so she didn't do any self-care. Other than you go to church and you pray to God, and God will help you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we grew up. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody but Jesus. She came in doing that era and going to church and listening to the preacher preach. Maybe it was, the psychology for her that she needed at the time. But real self-help that we talk about today, I'm for sure she didn't take care of herself that way. And me, being a young mother, and I shared this with Victoria, that my parenting skills, I parent out of fear that I did not want them to be a statistic, black young mother, and what do you expect from, her kids to be? Mm-hmm. I didn't want them to be a statistic. So I put the pressure on them and didn't listen to, how they were feeling.
Mm. How about now? How do you take care of yourself now?
Now I take care of myself. I don't do the formal, as you say, counseling, but I talk it out. I talk it out with Victoria. I've always talked to, even raising the children, I always talk to older women that I respected, like at church and things like that. And I have a lady at the office now I've had issues, with Torrance and I, and talking out to her because she can be unbiased about the situation. So I do talk more about my feelings, inner thoughts, and I talk it out. When we first had to stay home to work and being in the house just 24/7, and I started to feel the isolation and loneliness, I did pick up the phone and call my friend from the office to talk it out with, and she, helped me get through it, because I kept saying the isolation is real, and why does God want me to be here by myself, isolated? I don't understand this. I'm a good person. And then I start thinking, well, maybe I did something, I know better, and when you know better, you do better. Mm-hmm. And reading, of course, self-help books.
Well, what are you reading, Nana? Tell me.
I'm not reading anything right now.
Do you have any favorite books that you would recommend to folks listening, any young Black folks listening who want to, just dive into new literature or even old literature?
Well, I'll have to get them out of my bookcase because, I'm old and I can't remember titles. But I certainly will send them to you.
Yes, send them to me and I'll put them in the episode notes for sure.
Yeah, I will send them to you. And I think about my mom a lot and how she sacrificed and got through life. And one thing she did share with me, my father, who's from Sumter, South Carolina, And was proud man, and he did not want to work for, as he said, the white man. And he tried, and his brothers, numerous. I remember early on, I was very young, they had a poultry shop right on 11th and R in Street in D.C. And next thing I know, that had failed. And then his older brother, Chester, they, I think Uncle Bill was in it too. They tried a restaurant. So his businesses, you know, they did. And he wasn't as strong as my mother, but he turned to alcohol and he became an alcoholic. And that caused my mother and father to separate. And she did say, this was, oh, I don't know how old I was then, but I think I was probably maybe in my 30s or so. And she did say if she understood alcoholism like she does now, she probably would not have left him. But what she knows now, maybe she would have helped him. And
you know, I'm just so grateful for you and your story and your major, major role in raising me. I have so many fond memories with you.
Yeah.
We were road dogs. And now, you know, the fact that you are still here to love on my children. And
I appreciate that, Alexandra. I say, and I would give thanks every Thanksgiving that I am so proud of Victoria and Torrance and where they are, and looking at you, and that all of this is started from me, and how the cycle, and you always want your child to be, how do you say, the next generation does better. My mom, you know, she looks at us and say, our generation did better. And then I can look at Victoria and Torrance and say how well they've done. And now looking at you with your family, it makes me weep when I think about it, that I am still here and I can witness this. And I'm so thankful to God.
Nina, yeah. I love you. I love you.
And I tell people all the time, I'm a woman of faith, and without God, I don't think this would have happened, because he brought me through and protected me, you know, and I can see the work that I've done.
Nina, thank you. Thank you. I love you.
Oh, thank you. And I'm honored that you wanted to hear my story.
Always. I will keep this forever and ever and ever and ever. Thanks for listening to the show today. Please rate, subscribe, and review. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We love having our community grow. Music is by DC's own Kokai.
The Hey Girl podcast is produced by Wayne Bartram and me, Alex L.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.